Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. It's a great evening out here. It's actually a pretty nice evening, although we're waiting for a rainstorm, which, knowing my luck, it'll blow in and blow the satellite out, my satellite uplink. Boy, I'll tell you, Kansas has got some real serious communication problems. You know what I mean? Between the Tea Party movement and the tiny, itty-bitty progressive community, which is growing. Progressive community, people who understand what's going on about the big changes in the land are beginning to get a grasp of things, I think. Kansas might pull itself out. I have one quick note, and I want to make a program note for people, and then we're going to go right into this great conversation with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould on Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, on a special broadcast tonight on the 8th anniversary of the bloody invasion of Afghanistan by America. This Friday, October 16th, 2009, at the John Brown statue on 27th Street and Sewell Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. That's the John Brown statue at 27th and Sewell Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. The John Brown Society will be sponsoring at 5:30 p.m. a commemoration of the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry. And everybody's welcome. That's at 5:30, October 16th, at the John Brown statue in Kansas City, Kansas. Well, this book I got from, it's published by City Lights. It's incredibly reviewed. It's got a list of stars from around the publishing community. Kirkus Review gives it a great review. Publisher Weekly gave it a starred review. Robert Dreyfus, Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Robert Dreyfus gave it one. And my buddy, one of the guys I look up to and study, I don't claim to understand all of it, Chomsky, professor at MIT. He's got one. I'll read some of these reviews at the break. Sheila Guest Harrison, former South Asia bureau chief, Washington Post, and author of Out of Afghanistan. And also Ahmed Rashid, author of Taliban, Jihad, and the Descent into Chaos. This is by City Lights Books. I'm going to put a permalink at the flyer and at the Discomfort Magazine and my other blogs, or you can order this book. This book is a have-to for your bookshelves. You really need this to understand what's going on in Afghanistan. This is an incredible. It's in the news every day. I'm more than happy to broadcast this. Now, without further ado, here is Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald in a conversation recorded just last weekend. Folks, This is one of the, I would rank this interview up with Chalmers, Johnson, some of the more important people I've talked to. This is a real honor for us to be listening to, for you guys to be listening to. Listeners, this is a really important time in our country's history right now. We're approaching a point where President Obama is going to have to make some key decisions, and I don't want to leap forward to that. First, I want to tell you about Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould's book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. It is one of the, frankly, candidly, damnedest books I've ever read in my life. It really exposes and gives away the really complicated history of this country that has been, for lack of better terms, tortured. Tortured over a 40, 50, 60-year history, an unbelievable history. It's gotten incredible reviews from people like Noam Chomsky. It's got a starred review from Publishers Weekly. It's one of the most important books you can have on your shelves. I've went back to it several times since reading it. I've looked at it, pondered what they've written. This is an incredible book, and I'm really honored to have Gould and Fitzgerald. When I got that email, I thought it was a law firm. But you guys
different kind of law.
That's right, and you write very professionally. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, Paul Fitzgerald, Elizabeth Gould. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having us on.
Yes, thanks. We're glad to be here.
Well, Kansas listeners, I'll tell you right now, Paul and Elizabeth, if I may call you that, sometimes in the heat of political debates out here, I've referred to the people out here, my political opponents, as peasants, who, in certain ways, I used to think, condescendingly and wrongfully, that this was like I was dealing sometimes with people who beat their wives, had an inordinate affectation that carried on towards a fundamentalist religion, and was dominated by a theocratic government in the state house at Topeka. But I assure you, I've never read of the experiences. If we're ever invaded, God forbid, if Kansas is ever invaded by a superpower, there's nothing in comparison. Afghanistan is certainly one of the most incredible countries I've ever read about. I had no idea. And I have one question to start off. The cover of your book, the beautiful photograph of this densely populated valley, and in the distance is these white snow-capped mountains. Where did you get that photo? That's a great photo. That's an amazing photo.
Wish I could admit that I took that myself, but that was actually that was offered to us by our publisher.
Well,
that's a village on the backside of the city of Kabul. Kabul's in the mountains. And, you know, it's just such an exquisite place. When you get there, your plane comes down, through this very narrow passage. And at one point, I flew in after going to Jalalabad. I flew back at the end of the day with the crew. And the wind was coming over the mountains, and it was just incredibly beautiful. But
uh-huh.
The plane could not set down flat. It was coming in sideways. And one wing was about a foot, maybe 2 feet off the runway. And I thought to myself, well, at least it's a beautiful place to go. I have to end it here.
Yeah.
It'd be a beautiful place to end it. But the Afghan pilot was just amazing. He just gunned the left engine and flattened the plane out and then dropped it on the tarmac.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It was just one of those moments that you have in a lifetime, you know.
Yeah, well, hopefully it's only once in a lifetime. Now, according to what I've read, you guys have been there on and off for over 30 years. You produced a documentary, and could you start out from the beginning? What was your inclination to start to go over there? What was 30 years ago? What was going on then?
Well, actually, we were actually working. This would have been in the late 1970s.
Yeah.
President Carter had come into office. He came in on a platform of reducing arms spending. We were going to have détente with the Soviet Union. There was going to be an entire shift in the economy from a military competition with the Soviets to a civilian. If there was a competition, it was going to be civilian. And at that time, Paul was working at a television station. It was actually the Christian Broadcasting Network, and he actually had their only non-sectarian broadcasting. He was actually there at the, you know, meeting the FCC requirement of having balanced programming. So when the station was airing a Strategic Arms Limitation documentary that was against it, Paul went to the management and said, basically, well, you know, we're going to have to do something to show the other side of this issue. So that became our first production together. Paul and I produced a documentary called The Arms Race and the Economy, A Delicate Balance.
Huh.
And what we did is we interviewed a number of people like the, you know, Paul Warnke, who negotiated the SALT Treaty, and John Kenneth Galbraith, who was talking about the impact of arms spending and how important it was at this point that the effects of the Vietnam War had been so devastating to the economy, and that that was what this whole reinvestment was going to be about, reinvesting in infrastructure and in civilian economy needs. So we came out with this documentary shortly after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And what we observed was a shift in the ability of their organizations, government officials, all kinds of people that we were interacting with suddenly shifted from the idea of détente and negotiation simply evaporated. And we simply made note of it. It seemed too spontaneous, too amazing. It was like you knew instantaneously that there had been events that the American people were not aware of that preceded the Soviet invasion.
Yes, there was also a lack of discussion about it at any kind of political level. You know, I mean, you turn on the news and you get a reporter for ABC standing there saying, everybody agrees the United States needs a military buildup. The question is, how big and how long, how extensive does it have to be? With that kind of, it was a series of do you still beat your wife questions, you know?
Yeah.
And so we said, wait a minute, this just doesn't make sense. You know, we're falling. I feel as if it's, you know, I'm a kid again back in the, back in the Cold War. And you know, we're suddenly going back in a mindset without reexamining why we were in Vietnam, as an example.
Uh-huh.
So I think in order to really understand our mindset, what we had come up with, we got involved in a political campaign in 1976, and we saw, you know, Jimmy Carter elected on a platform of reducing tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, of extending détente, which had, of course, been initiated during the Johnson administration, the beginning of the Nixon administration.
Really, yeah.
The objective of which, of course, was to lessen the financial tensions on the United States, the financial strains that were caused by Vietnam, and to lessen political tensions between the United States and Russia. And so by capping the number of nuclear weapons that was at that point really out of control, multiple reentry vehicles were coming online.
Oh, I remember MIRVs. Yeah.
Oh,
right,
yeah, right. All that stuff was just on the drawing board. I mean, the MX missile, remember the MX missile?
Yeah.
That was one of the answers that was going around, you know, that should the United States build the MX missile or not, or should they just simply get the Soviets to stop building their long-range missile and we'd stop building our long-range missile.
Uh-huh.
And then they finally came up with some kind of scheme whereby they said, well, the whole point of the MX missile is that, you know, it's vulnerable. If you put it in a silo, this huge thing in a silo, then the Russians will know where it is, and they just simply target the silo with a bigger missile.
Yeah.
So they said, all right, let's figure out how to get around that. So what they did was they said, well, we'll put it on a vehicle, and we'll drive it around in a truck, and they'll never find it. So this is the kind of thing that was going on at the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So when we got to Afghanistan in 1981, we asked for permission from the Afghan about 2 weeks after the Soviets had invaded. They expelled the entire Russian media from Afghanistan. So during that time period, when we finally got the documentary on the air, we discovered that there was just simply no interest for arms control. There was no interest for détente. There was no interest in bettering the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. So we discovered a very, very different Afghanistan when we got there. And what we discovered was that the agenda that we had witnessed
uh-huh.
in 1979 and 1980 really was coming. There was a dynamic. It was almost as if the hawks in the United States were playing a game with the hawks in the Soviet Union, and everybody else was getting left behind, including the Afghan people.
Yeah, that's really a good way of putting it, too, after reading your book, and it's had an effect on me and the way I look at who is determining these policies and how they're determined, and the long-standing strategic effects of it. I guess that's why they call it policy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But it's almost as if there was a lockdown on that policy. There was no way it was going to deviate from one way or the other. As the Soviet Union seemed to be going into the area, there was no. It sounded from your book and from what I remember, and I'm old enough to remember, there was very little discussion going on about options, other than basically, countering everything that the Soviet Union did. The Red Menace enters into Afghanistan. I don't think they understood. I didn't know that there were many, many different social factors involved in Afghanistan at that time. It wasn't just a feudal country, F-E-U-D-A-L country, a feudal country. Your book is really exposes that there's a deep and rich history to Afghanistan that I never knew about. Could you continue with your trip? How did it? So what happened when you got? Happened? Go ahead.
We ended up what happened in December 27, 1979, when the Soviets crossed that border, and we realized that some crisis had occurred within the administration, because you could see the shift was so stark. When President Carter labeled it the greatest threat to peace since the Second World War, what we looked at on the ground was the fact that the Soviet Union had a long-standing relationship with Afghanistan. It was well-defined as within the Soviet sphere of influence. So there were a lot of things that just didn't add up. So what's coming out of the American media at that time was the beginning of the story about the evil empire and, against the holy wars. That was just the beginning of the story. It hadn't been completely formulated at that moment. But that really was the framing the story was taking on. So when we got there in 1981 and saw that Afghanistan was a very complex story that really had to do with a civil war in Afghan society, and that the government, even though it was Marxist, was actually very, very involved with Islam. There was a tremendous amount of Islamic activity and presence, and mullahs who were very willing to talk about their version of Islam.
Uh-huh.
What President Barbara Karmal stated for our camera was that this was a war by the Islamists, and he called it American Islam versus progressive Islam.
Isn't that interesting? Yes.
And he said this was a war being financed by the United States from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia against basically progressive Islam. Well, what was progressive Islam? Women's rights was a very big issue. And that was one of the most outstandingly obvious activities, the desire to really have tremendous education opportunities and all kinds of the more visible signs of what we in the West would consider very much typical modernization process for women's rights. And so this was the thing that the Islamists, who were really coming over the border from Pakistan, were fighting against. They were burning down schools. They were burning, the power lines were being blown up, and all kinds of mayhem to basically make it impossible for the government to function. But on the outside, the story was basically that this was a Soviet takeover, and that this was really the next step to the Persian Gulf. This was a big part of the story that was coming out inside the United States. So when we came back with the story that said, no, there may be a larger geopolitical issue here between the Soviet Union and the United States, which at that point we didn't know exactly how the Soviets were, and we didn't know at that point that it was an active policy on the part of Zbigniew Brzezinski to draw the Soviets into Afghanistan and trap them there. What we could see clearly was that there was a country called Afghanistan within its own crisis, and it was a completely different story that was being presented. And the United States, it was just the evil empire against the holy warriors.
See, it really kicked into high gear in 1978 when the Marxist coup came along. A number of things happened during that time period, in that part of the world. Iran, our relationship with the Shah of Iran was getting very shaky. That was America's major client in the region, who was pushing. One of the things that the documents that I uncovered in my research was that the Shah of Iran was actually planning to intervene with U.S.-backed military forces into Afghanistan And this would have been, well, the coup was in April of 1978, so that would have been a long time before the Soviets even anticipated invading Afghanistan.
Uh-huh, right.
So there was a very aggressive Western American effort to try to move up into that region. After Southeast Asia, or after Vietnam, that became an area of interest to the United States and an area of confrontation. So what you've got is what's interesting is that the right wing in the United States, of course, looked at the Marxist coup and of 1978 and said, aha, see, the Soviets are moving in more aggressively into Afghanistan. Well, you see, once again, it's, you know, you get part of the story. The Marxist coup of 1978 was a Marxist faction that would have been the last people that Moscow would have wanted taking over an adjoining country. The group that took over was known as the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. But it had two factions. It had a Moscow-based faction, and it had a Peking-based faction.
Really? Yeah.
Based faction. The Maoist-oriented group. It was the Maoist-oriented group that took over in 1978.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't put that together at that. That's amazing. I knew there was some intrigue going on between the two. For lack of better terms, these self-styled, self-described socialist empires.
Yeah, exactly. And they were both very—they're both minority parties. This is just it. I mean, if you look at the documents, the KGB documents, as an example, that have been made available, and you can see that the KGB was telling the PDPA leadership, "Don't do this. Don't overthrow the government.
Right.
You don't have the." You know, the kind of constituency. You don't have support in the countryside. You've only got the urban working class and middle class in the society. You don't have...
And that wasn't that long.
You don't have a broad base. Exactly. That was a very small group of people. It was the intelligentsia, essentially. So it was a revolution from the top. But even then, even within that revolution, it was split between what was called the Kalk faction, which was the Maoist-oriented faction, and the Pasham, which was the Moscow-oriented faction. So when Kalk took over, immediately, they were very radical, they were very Maoist. Remember what was going on in China.
Yeah,
in
fact, the aftermath of the Cultural Revolution.
The Cultural Revolution. Well, that was the kind of thing that the Kalk was advocating for Afghanistan. Raise the people up, you know, throw off the bonds of feudalism, come, you know, crashing into the 20th century. You know, they were going into these villages and forcing women to remove their veils. It was just... It was a disaster.
But there's another fact, though, that you have to realize, that, in fact, that it was the Afghan monarchy that, starting back in the early 1920s, was actually implementing modernization very effectively.
Yes, I have to interrupt you. I got that email from you that your book is being quoted in a position paper prepared for the Canadian government, and I was amazed to hear that there were rights to vote for women's suffrage in Afghanistan before the United States.
That's right.
Go ahead. Exactly. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
But not only were women given the right to vote, but we have to realize that unlike the American women, the Afghan women didn't have to ask for that right. It was given to them. So you can see that there was very, very advanced thinking in terms of these Western ideas of modernization. There was a lot of attempt on the part of King Amanullah to really bring these ideas, and they were being accepted even by the conservative community in Afghanistan. As the article stated, as the quote stated in the Canadian
and that's counter to what we're receiving today in America.
Exactly.
That there's today, many people, many of my fellow Kansans and people who listen to my radio show, are subjected to these bombardments, propaganda salvos, basically that that all Islam is anti-woman.
Exactly. And certainly in the case of Afghanistan, this has been a process. In fact, if you can actually go back to the original origin of the yearnings of the Afghan nation, this would have been in the 16th century, mystical Pashtun Sufi philosopher Bayezid Ansari, his original idea for the new nation he was thinking of was a nation where there'd be equality amongst men and women and education for both men and women. So this was in the 16th century that this idea was forming, was in the very beginnings of the yearnings of this of the people that became, the Pashtun people that became the nation. This didn't happen until 1747, but that was even before the United States was formed.
Oh, yeah.
So we can see that the idea that Afghanistan has been a long-standing nation that has shown tremendously advanced ideas in terms of social structures. This is another, I think, idea that really is shocking for people. This would have been in the 1830s when the British East India Company sent political officer Alexander Burnes in to advance the offices of the British Empire. He wrote a letter back to his mother in 1832. "The people of this country are kind-hearted and hospitable. They have no prejudice against the Christian and none against our nation." Now, this was written in 1832. And by 1839, even after Burnes had recommended that the Afghan nation be viewed as an ally, a partner, and a strong Afghanistan was in the best interest of the British Empire, the British ended up in having their first war in 1839, which turned out to be a disaster for the British Empire. So that shows you the beginning of this. And again, the idea that the Afghan people don't like invaders, well, I'd like to say I don't like invaders. Do you?
Yeah,
does anybody like to be invaded? No. This is an absurd way of rationalizing, really, trying to position a kind of a fantasy Afghanistan.
Hmm.
The people were very hospitable to anybody coming through. In fact, Afghanistan actually has been well known even up until the late 19th. Even during the Soviet occupation, you still had many of the feeling that this was a place where that they welcomed different kinds of belief systems. This was something that was known, in fact, in the 1970s, our Afghan friends tell us it was the Paris of the region. This was considered to be a very cosmopolitan city. And again, just like in the United States, where you have rural is always different from urban.
Yeah.
And in Afghanistan, needless to say, you had the same kind of phenomenon. But it wasn't as if the more conservative aspects of Afghan's nation were against the urban development. There was a coexistence and there was a balance. But what happened when Hafizullah Amin came in and began to implement these brutal and very, very unacceptable method of trying to modernize, that's what was rejected, but not women's rights fundamentally,
mm-hmm.
not the idea that women shouldn't be educated. In fact, at that point, Afghanistan had a very large educated class, which included women in many positions of authority, including working on television and as interviewers and involved in all kinds of doctors and lawyers and things like that.
This was in 1981 when you went there. There was also an interesting point. The visa that was granted, I don't know what they call that. That's where you received that directly from the. Mm-hmm. That was a rarity, I guess. That was one of the few, if only time.
They weren't letting anybody in.
Right.
No, they were not letting any Western media in. I think they had let it. Later that year, I think they allowed a Japanese crew to go in. But certainly, what we did was we said, look at. You know, they're saying all kinds of things. Because our awareness of what was going on with the arms race and how Afghanistan was being used essentially as pump to prime the arms race, we said, this blackout that you've imposed on Western journalists is really doing you more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't let anybody in there to see what you're trying to accomplish, then they're just going to have a field day on you. And so what we're going to do is what we proposed was that we would go in with a TV crew and that we would contract with a network to tell our story about what we saw. And that was what we did. We contracted the opportunity to do that with CBS News, and CBS was very anxious to have us go in and look around and stay as long as we wanted to. The Afghans, of course, didn't want us there very long. But from what we understood was even at the time was that moving around to Afghanistan, we went over to NBC at one point and we told them what we were doing. They said, well, yeah, you can go and we'll give you a contract for right of first refusal. Look at what you got and see if it's of any interest to us. And that's not what we wanted. It was a very expensive undertaking back in those days, and you couldn't put your camera in your pocket, and walk through customs. You had to.
Yeah.
We lugged two very heavy-duty tape recorders with us out of New York, a very expensive camera that was rented for the occasion, and other kinds of boxes and assorted lights and all kinds of other equipment. that was probably today would be worth, at the time was worth probably $500,000 worth of equipment.
Oh.
We had to lug that through a half a dozen different airports, flew it to India, and then flew it by Afghan Ariana Airlines into Kabul. I mean, it was a big ordeal, and so we needed the backing. Also, too, I mean, it was so dangerous at the time that CBS News took out $1 million insurance policy on each of the people in the crew.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In order to do this, because they just say, well, you know, you may not come back. So we didn't know exactly what we were getting into
right.
under the circumstances, but that's what it was. And so when we came back, of course, CBS News wasn't especially interested in a story about Afghan women getting educated, or the fact that these rebels, you know, over the mountains and blowing up power lines and burning down schools. That was not interesting. That what they were interested in was, of course, you know, the Soviets looked at those, you know, Sam, did you get any pictures of the Sam missiles at the, at the Air Force base or at the, at Kabul Airport? And of course, we did actually, we did get stuff like that, and that's what they were interested in. But so that's when we did our documentary, Afghanistan Between Three Worlds, which went out on PBS. And what we were doing was we were running very much counter to, you know, what the popular theories of the Reagan agenda were that the Soviet Union was on a bent. They were on a tear that were going to take over the Persian Gulf, and they were going to conquer the Middle East, and they were running out of oil, and that they were going to be basically stopping the United States from pursuing any kind of agenda in the Middle East. And so that's what we were saying. We're saying we don't really think that that's what they're there for. We really think that what they're doing is fighting terrorism on their southern border. And they made a mistake, and that's what we discovered. We went back in 1983 with Roger Fisher from the Harvard Negotiation Project. Roger saw an early version of our documentary and came up and said, if there's anything I can do on this story, he said, this is terrific what you're doing. He says, you're really opening up the lines of communication between the East and the West that have been frozen by this Cold War mentality. And I said, well, would you be interested in going back with us?
Oh my God.
So he said, yeah, that'd be great. So I said, well, let's do the story. Let's go back to Afghanistan and find out what it would take to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Given that President Carter had stood up on the podium and announced the fact that the Soviets being in Afghanistan was the greatest threat to peace since World War II, well, what if we can get them to go home? Let's go and officially find
right.
out what's going on there. And so that's what we did. In 1983, we contracted to ABC News Nightline, and we put together a second trip, and that was a. I'll let Liz reveal the details.
Yeah, well, it's a great. Go on.
Okay. Well, yeah, we just like with CBS, we came up against the resistance to the complex story, but in this case, the complex story was straightforward. What we discovered was that the Soviets made it very clear that they were desperate to get out and that they
really?
Needed. Yes, and that
remember,
this
was 1983.
83. This is the war.
83.
The invasion and the war had taken on. The occupation had been going on for quite a time at that point. They were receiving casualties on a daily basis. Go ahead.
They actually talked about the fact that there were many drug addictions. That they were definitely. And we also know now. Don't forget that in 1983, the Soviet Union was already, needless to say, having internal difficulties that eventually
mm-hmm.
led to its complete unraveling in 1991. So we know that when the Soviets realized they had made a huge mistake, and again, we actually should pull the clock back a little earlier. We really need to pull the clock back to Zbigniew Brzezinski activating the Black Project at least 6 months prior to the Soviet invasion that he got President Carter to sign that was designed to intentionally draw the Soviets in, enhance the chances, I think that was the word he used enhance the chances that the Soviets would be drawn into Afghanistan and that once they were drawn there, they could trap them in their own Vietnam. So that was part of the thinking that was going on inside the White House, and that when that was activated 6 months prior to the Soviet invasion, of course, when the Soviets crossed the border and President Carter announced the significance of this as such a great threat, we now know that President Carter was quite aware of the fact that there was intentional provocation on the southern border. So when we went there in 1983, what we were then getting from the Soviets was how really desperate they were already becoming
right.
and their awareness that they really had to withdraw. But the one condition of the withdrawal was going to be the insurgency had to stop from Pakistan, and that was the big crisis. In 1983, there was an insurgency that was not being reported in the American press about the financing that was going on from the United States and Saudi Arabia. There was an intentional, kind of obfuscation of the of who was really behind it. And again, at that point, the American media had really picked up the idea of the evil empire and the holy warriors, and that became the framing of the story. So nothing really had to be analyzed or discussed. So we come back to Nightline with something that totally challenges the very foundation of the idea that the Soviets are determined to not only take over Afghanistan, but they're on their way to the Persian Gulf. We come back with a story that says, no, the Soviets are desperate to get out. The only thing the U.S. has to do is stop the financing and get the Pakistanis to stop the insurgency coming from Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
If we bring this to Nightline, and what we discover is that the way the program was framed and the way that Koppel handled it, Ted Koppel handled the interviews and the people they chose, managed to give the impression there really was no point in even taking this seriously, that Roger Fisher explaining the conditions under which they needed to be helped to get out was simply not worth even trying to challenge the Soviets, even trying to give them any reason to get out. Well, within about a year, in 1984, that's when you begin to see the effects of Representative Charlie Wilson's budget.
The famous Wilson's War.
Wilson's War.
Yeah, that's all now a movie and all that. I watched that before I read your book, and I was struck by the simplistic notion, the way they put it in, and then the snowball effect. And then after I read your book, I went back and watched that movie again, and I realized it didn't mention the Brzezinski. It didn't mention anything about that they literally spawned or sparked a lot, fueled and financed a lot of the horrible things that were going on months and months, years. It sounds like years before Charlie Wilson got involved in it. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, that's exactly. But that's one of the reasons why Washington is having such a difficult problem in Afghanistan today. In fact, I'd say it's the major problem,
mm-hmm.
is because they believe their own press releases in Washington. They really thought they were having an impact with this thing. And what they believed was far beyond what they were actually doing. In fact, you read some of the commentary from Soviet generals when they're asked to come to these conferences, over the 90s and into the early 2000s, and they were asked specifically, how badly did we hurt you with our Stinger missiles? And they said, well, what we did was we learned how to evade them, and we just flew higher when we dropped our bombs, so we caused more casualties. That's essentially was the impact. The fact was that the Soviet Union was imploding.
Uh-huh.
It had been one of the things that we did in the for our original documentary on the arms race back in 1979. We had interviewed Paul Warnke, who was the negotiator for the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. And, and we went back in 1993 and asked him, we said, well, what do you think of what was going on then? He said the Soviets were basically afraid. That's pretty much what they were trying to do. And he said that he and Robert McNamara had gone to the Soviet Union. This would have been the beginnings of detente. This would have been 1967 and 1968.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And he said that they went over there, and he said when they went over there for meetings, he said that they were greeted by a lot of mid-level bureaucrats, the kind of Gorbachev types, Yeltsin, Gorbachev, these guys at the time would have been in their 30s or
right.
40s. And they said to him, they said, look it, we know our system is running out of gas. We know that we don't have enough, we can't generate enough capital. We can't generate enough of an economy to support this thing for, another 25 years. We're going down. The problem is that we have this huge military establishment that protects the homeland. How do we get out from under this? Our hawks appeal to your hawks, and they both are at dueling, and all the rest of us are left out of the picture. What can we do? And that was really the beginnings. That was the kind of brainstorm that started detente in the late 60s, and it was picked up by the Nixon administration. And this was considered to be a good thing because it took the pressure off the budget to have to develop all these new weapons, and that was a big deal. As you recall, back in 1973, the United States went off the gold standard.
Right.
The United States had run up such a bill paying for Vietnam and was in debt to the Japanese and to the Germans. And the Germans and the Japanese saw the United States starting to inflate the currency. They saw the inflation setting in, and they said, we want to be paid back in gold. We don't want to be paid in dollars anymore because you guys are just inflating the dollars. So pay us in gold. So the Nixon administration was confronted with this catastrophe, and particularly with the oil crisis and everything else that was going on at the time. And so they simply took it off the gold standard. So everybody got to regulate the economies, and the entire economy changed. But that was a major shift that was going on. And so that's what was all the 70s were, a very volatile time, except the fact is that a lot of the fundamental issues about what was going on, about the way the United States approached its role in the world, the way in which it had done Vietnam, were never really addressed. Okay? Those issues, instead, we got back into we did it once and we can do it again type of mantra, you know, from World War II,
right.
and we got the Reagan administration in the 80s, and then everybody kind of went to sleep because everybody was making money on the stock market. And all of a sudden in 2007 and 2008,
yep.
Everyone woke up and said, wait a minute, you know, what kind of a financial system do we really have here? What kind of, you know, what are we doing in Afghanistan? Suddenly we've got generals appearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee testifying that, you know, oh, yes, we've been in Afghanistan now for 7 years, but, you know, Taliban and al-Qaeda are stronger than ever. How did this happen? Where did it come from?
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that we did the book for, was to try to give you that window into, give Americans a window into the way our government works and versus what was really going on at the time and on the scene. What the Afghan people were looking for, what the Afghan leadership was trying to accomplish by advancing their country slowly between two empires, between the Russian Empire and the British Empire,
mm-hmm.
and how they were managing to do that bit by bit, decade by decade, and how when the 70s came along, the Cold War finally caught up with them, and what we're living with today is a result of all of that 20th century confusion.
Yes, and it sounds strangely, crisis of the U.S. Empire in the 1970s in the aftermath of Vietnam sounds strangely familiar to many people now who sit and watch TV and see everybody in the last 6 months a deluge of commercials saying send in your so-called broken gold, and people all over the internet talking about the distinct possibility of the United States no longer the dollar, no longer being part of the foreign currency reserve.
Right.
And other countries like Iran and others, and Venezuela starting up bourses, I don't know how you pronounce that.
Bourses, yeah.
And setting up alternate means, China saying we may need a basket full of currencies in order to establish a foreign currency. This is strangely familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who our age can remember some of that. I know many of my young listeners who come over to my farm regularly, we discuss that, and you encapsulated it quite well, Paul. Thank you. I mean, that's
well, you know, we come with a perspective, you know, coming from our age group. I mean,
yeah,
my father was in World War II. He was in Europe for 2 years with the Army, and my Liz's father welded Liberty Ships at Brooklyn Harbor. I mean, it was all part of our consciousness back then. You know,
we
grew up with it. I mean, you know, I still have my Eisenhower jacket. It's in a closet, you know.
Right.
The idea that this, we were inculcated with this. We came up out of the product of World War II. We grew up in the 1950s in the middle of the Cold War. Then came Vietnam. We always were at war with somebody. When I was in high school, in college, you were always, you know, thinking about everything that you did based on this, on your deferment, you know, for the draft. You know, that if you left the semester, you decided that you had to get a job to pay for another semester worth of college or something like that. Leave college, go, you know, if I go and take a job for a semester, I got a nice job when I was 19 and 20 years old, and that a professional singer at the time, as well as a writer. And I thought, geez, you know, the opportunity to go and, you know, just get a good week's pay, you know, and then just take a semester off, but you couldn't do that sort of thing because of the draft. You know,
right.
You left, and 6 months later, you'd be called in by the draft board, and you'd be sent off to Vietnam. So, You know, these were things you always thought about. They were ever present. And so when the 70s came and we got into the war ended and Jimmy Carter was up for election and came in with this platform of denuclearizing the world and backing off against the Soviet Union and ending the Cold War, it's like, oh, thank God. You know, this is really, this is wonderful. You know, this is finally, you know, the clouds have opened, the sun is coming out, and you know, this is the way we felt. We were all in our 20s, and we felt that, you know, this was really worth something. This was really the change that we had all hoped would be coming, and suddenly we just watched this whole thing unravel.
You know, it's interesting, though, when you really look at what was going on inside the Carter administration, mm-hmm. you really have a window into a crisis that really does harken back to the, you know, World War II and then the beginning of the Cold War. And what you're looking at in terms of Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and his efforts to actually promote, this was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State, to promote, go along the path of negotiation and more in the direction of detente. And then you had National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who basically brought in an absolutely black and white agenda
mm-hmm.
that said, no, we cannot coexist with the Soviet Union. And that became a crisis within the Carter administration. So here Carter comes in on this platform, but yet this battle was being waged inside, and what ended up happening was Brzezinski won the battle. That's what happened.
You recall, I mean, you up until the Nixon administration, you had to be born in the United States of America in order to be the Secretary of State. That was part of the requirement, okay? For the simple reason that the Secretary of State represented the interests of the American people overseas and the interests of the United States overseas. That was changed for Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger was a geopolitician who came in and said, okay, it's a whole new ball game now. So suddenly, you know, people tend to look at, you know, liberal democratic machines as, you know, regimes as being the times when these things occur. This was during the Nixon administration.
Yeah.
Nixon opened the door to China as an example. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union's no longer a communist nation. China is still a communist nation. I mean, they just celebrated their 60th anniversary, grand celebration. And by the way, there was an announcement that a lot of people probably missed last week. There was an article. There was an article in the China Daily by a major bureaucrat in the Chinese establishment who basically said that the United States should withdraw from Afghanistan. They said that the United States is causing more harm than good there, and it's time for the United States to get out. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, where, of course, in Washington right now, the issue is being debated as to whether, you know, the United States should, you know, should, whether the United States should escalate, should 40,000 more troops be in there, or should the United States take on, once again, resume a kind of anti-terrorist policy, which got the United States in the problem it's in the first place.
Yes, and in the meantime, we should continue to go to Walmart and buy all the Chinese goods we can.
Yeah, I mean, there is something of a dichotomy there, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Well, and plus, now I'm going to go back to your book, but I want to throw, since we're moving this, I'd like to throw a curveball question at you. What do you think if you were a fly on the wall of Air Force One going to Copenhagen last week, would you have heard between General McChrystal and Obama and his trip over there for the Olympics? That's the big talk I heard on the McLaughlin Report this morning. I have to watch that stuff because that's what my listenership watches and asks me about. Do you, what do you think? What do you think was going on between General McChrystal and President Obama on Air Force One last week?
Well, you know, first of all, the issues are big. This is not Vietnam. I mean, basically what Washington does is Washington does Vietnam. In Vietnam, it was a quagmire, okay? But the United States goes into other countries, works with other countries, you know, has military advisors in a lot of different places, okay? It doesn't turn out to be Vietnam. And the fact is that in Afghanistan...
Well, plus we have... Well, no, I'm sorry. But plus we have hundreds and hundreds of more military bases now in the empire than we did back then.
Lee Thomas Johnson's work. I mean, that's been his life's work is to reveal the extensive array and network of military bases around the world. We have an enormous military establishment.
Uh-huh.
We've put, you know, many, many trillions of dollars since 1945 in the establishment and courting these various regimes around the world. We still have active military bases in Japan and in Germany from World War II, I mean, the end of World War II. So, you know, this is obviously a long-term plan at stake. But the issue is that 40,000 troops is what is being asked for right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at standard, you know, counterterrorism doctrine and counterinsurgency doctrine, you would need somewhere in the vicinity of 550 to 800,000 troops in order to do the full counterinsurgency program correctly.
Uh-huh.
And that is not going to happen. There is not half a million troops available. The Europeans haven't got them. We haven't got them. Regardless of the fact that we have bases all over the world, those kind of boots on the ground is a major undertaking that simply is not, it's not possible. Okay? It's not politically possible, certainly. It's not financially possible. It's just not realistic. So unless there is a political agenda that goes along, and this is what's so disturbing. There was an article yesterday morning in the Financial Times whereby Rydell, who is the guy who constructed, he's a former CIA operative and administrator, who helped put the concept of AFPAC together, and Bruce Rydell. And Bruce Rydell stated, he said that since this was implemented, the AFPAC policy was implemented in March. He said that the policy, he said, has not changed. It has not been implemented on the ground. And so we are still in Afghanistan, we are still operating under the same Bush regime, basically the same counterterrorism regime that was going on failed from the beginning of 2001 until now. And so this is the issue. This is what it comes down to, is that regardless of what Washington seems to come up with, the amount of troops that they're proposing to put in there would pretty much rival what the Soviets had in there in the 1980s, okay? And we know what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan. But that would bring it up to the level that the Soviets had. Now, the fact is that even with that, it would be nowhere near the number that would be necessary to actually occupy the country.
There's another fact, too, that we cannot dismiss. The fact was that the Soviets were working with an Afghan government that did have an Afghan army, and that they were actually supporting an Afghan army.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really a very different situation, a totally different situation that was going on during the Soviet occupation. And I think in terms of the what's going on, I should hope this might be going on inside the inner sanctum of the Obama administration, is that there is a slow, maybe dim light coming through that very secret little area wherever they exchange these ideas, that there is a level of exposure in terms of the policy, the failure of the policy, that is unprecedented, and that there is an appreciation worldwide that these policies are failing. That's why you have the Chinese coming out and stating publicly they think the U.S. should get out, and that you have a lot of of Europeans that are definitely very anxious about the U.S. policy. And then you have Bruce Rydell coming out and making it clear that whatever good might have come from this AFPAC policy, they don't even know because it was never really implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really very disturbing. And I would imagine that little meeting between McChrystal and Obama must have been very disturbing for both of them.
For both of them. I really think McChrystal is trying to make a difference here. Everything I've seen about what he's trying to do,
mm-hmm.
I've read the piece that was leaked to the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago about what exactly the plan was for his 40,000 troops and, implementing this counterinsurgency strategy, which basically relies on, protecting the population and creating some kind of security. It, of course, is just simply a rewrite of what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam. And the there are a number of parallels between what the Afghan government, as an example, that was pretty much a product of the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the Vietnamese government in the 1960s, that was a product of the United States. And you've got rampant corruption. You have all kinds of issues where the government really doesn't control much of anything.
There's also another issue that I think your audience and basically Americans really need to really grasp. The billions and billions and billions of dollars that have been spent that supposedly was going for reconstruction barely made it into Afghanistan. We hear a lot about the corruption in the Karzai government, but that isn't where the corruption is most devastated Afghanistan the most. It's been the amount of corruption at the international level. So this is part of crisis. The Afghan people have been in a war state as a result of American foreign policy going back to Zbigniew Brzezinski. We can certainly look at him as the point man that really got this thing rolling. And the whole idea of financing the extremists who were invited from around the world, Arab extremists were brought in, plane loads of them were brought in, billions of dollars that Charlie Wilson was able to really get rolling. It was started before that, but he really got it rolling in the high gear, including the Stinger missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Training, and these were individuals who were taken out of prisons. They were criminals. I think it's more important to think of these Islamists as criminals rather than Islamists. That's what's important. Not every person who happens to be an Islamist might be a criminal. These were criminals in many cases, drug lords, and they came out of criminal backgrounds. So you're looking at a situation that really was left when 1989, the Soviets withdraw. This is what these empowered individuals that were financed through Pakistan, were trained in Pakistan, were now allowed to war over who would take over Afghanistan. They believe, you know, at least 50,000 Afghans were killed in that skirmish between the Mujahideen groups warring over who should take over.
Oh, really?
The Afghan people have always been left out of the equation. And what's even more important is the moderate Afghans have always been left out. And that's the most critical point to realize.
And we'll return with that. I'm going to take a coffee break, and we'll get back. Listeners, I suggest you take one, too. We'll be back with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould in just a minute. Yes, that is some kind of discussion and very pertinent. You know, I was watching PBS NewsHour tonight on a local affiliate out here in North Jefferson County, Kansas, and they had a very short segment plugging Frontline to a special screening of Frontline next Tuesday evening, and they had some significant clips. Now, they were just sound bites of General McChrystal yakking, talking about changing the strategy. And they had some cameo shots of, I believe they were Marines, walking through villages. And there's two things that came out of it. One, they talked about the difficulty of establishing human-to-human relationships in their Star Wars uniforms, getting out of their Humvees and walking through the villages and trying to visit with people. And they actually showed, I believe it was a second lieutenant, trying to visit with the village elders and other people who would talk to him, and him wouldn't. And there was a guy saying, well, you were here 3 years ago, and you made promises, and nothing changed. You gave false promises. And this young lieutenant, he said, well, that would change, and that, and he made, and make a long story short, basically the lieutenant, the young guy, went back repeatedly to the village, but he was transferred out before their generator, the village generator, I'm sure it was diesel or gasoline operated, their generator, which supplied the only electricity to the small village. By the way, they showed an extensive, very sophisticated irrigation system going around the village. It's very interesting. Seeing these glimpses into the village. It was beautiful, actually. And two months later, when this young lieutenant was shipped out, shipped out from that area of operation, the generator finally arrived. And the news show is pointing out the U.S. taxpayers, we're spending in the neighborhood of $5 billion a month in Afghanistan to support primarily the military, and I can't help but wonder the cost of the aid that is not getting there to the village. It took 2 months to get a generator there. It would have been better to send in non-uniformed. Paul and Elizabeth, they even said maybe a civilian affairs units of retirees, American retirees, to go into the village and into these different villages. And I was thinking, I thought, well, why don't they put up solar panels? They don't they don't need gasoline as much as they, you know, the solar alone would probably help them more so than the noisy damn generators that we hear out here in Kansas. Whenever it floods or the tornadoes or ice storm hits, we're stuck with these noisy generators. Well, I have neighbors going around trying to keep the freezers running. They'll charge up your, they'll bring the generator over and charge up your freezer, let it run for a few hours and freeze up the meat, then go on down the road if you don't have a generator. And a lot of people bought generators. I'm not saying that that's bad. I'm just saying it's interesting that we still look at the remedies in an old for these contradictions among the Afghanistan people in the old way, and our technology is even looked at in the old way. And I don't think there's any solution, but there's a lot of intrigue that's going on right now. And next Tuesday on PBS, we'll have a Frontline. It'll be interesting to watch. And as I said earlier, I'm going to go get me a cup of coffee, and I'll play a little music here, and I'll get back with you here in just a little bit.
Cry. lay down your morals and kill your pride. For the mountains are laughing, cause heaven's a lie. Well, we've nothing to live for, we'll live till we die. Our guns ever loaded, and our fingers ain't shy. They bed down each night on God's green hair. And never had much money, never had many cares. Their lands being empty, their country made bare. By strip malls and highways and industry's glare. Oh, I have nothing to live for. They live till they die. The guns, they're loaded and their fingers ain't shy. My name is freedom, you've tarnished me well. Well, blood painted my letters when the Twin Towers fell. You used me to sound war's ugly bell. Now you chant my name and you're marching to hell. Oh, you've nothing to live for. You live till you die. Your guns grown rusty and your fingers ain't shot. Well, now pistol and angels sit out in the fall. To bust out our freedom from the Beaver City Hall. They sawed off his bindings and cut off his chains. And that's when old freedom remembered his name. Oh, we nothing to live for. We live till we die. Our guns are loaded and our fingers ain't shot. Now they're sailing away, they ain't coming back. Oh, the best friend we got is the railroad track. Oh, we're just waiting for your old bones to crack. Until the day comes that your flesh we will hack. Oh, we've nothing to live for. We live till we die. Our guns have grown rusty. Time's passing you by.
Jack Klatt, K-L-A-T-T, search for him on the internet, an itinerant musician who happened to come through Jefferson County, Kansas, and stop by my farm, spent a couple days. Well, as I was saying, $5 billion a month, over 800 dead American soldiers, thousands and thousands of Afghanistan people, some hostile, many not, killed, maimed, and wounded. Horrible, horrible. It's a horrible situation we're in, folks. 8 years, just a few years, just a couple years, just a few months shorter than Vietnam and the American Revolution. It goes on and on. The military industrial complex, the empire. Do you really think it's going to keep going? I don't. Yeah, we need a serious review of what we've done. I heard today Glenn Beck and others are advocating all out, not just General McChrystal's 40,000, but all out war in Afghanistan. 2 weeks ago, well, you'll hear about it. Here we go. But the second part of my interview with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald from Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. By the way, their website where you can get the book and much more details, even a chapter, and a lot of the links to their most recent work at Invisible History. It's all one word, invisiblehistory.com. By the way, they received a considerable amount of problems getting this book and their story out from the mainstream media. If I have time, I'll relate that. Here we go. This next segment is approximately 40 minutes. Enjoy and learn. Listeners, you're back. We're back with these Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould on the book, this incredible book, Afghanistan's Untold Story, Invisible History, The Invisible History of Afghanistan, reviewed. It's got a starred review by Publishers Weekly. This is the second part. If you missed the first part, you won't, because I'll make sure you see it. But we took a coffee break, and I went into the kitchen, and my lifetime partner, she gave me a pot of coffee and had this really wide-eyed look in her face, and she says, "This is one of the most important interviews you've ever done, Mike." And I'm like, going, "Well, just let me finish getting the phone ready again, so we'll go back to it." She said, "Would you do me a favor?" I said, "Well, what is it?" She says, "Would you run two words by Elizabeth and Paul?" And I said, "Yeah." "I don't like you doing this. I don't like you." "No. Peak oil." She wants to know, what does oil have to do as a determining factor in the history of this conflict between these big empires, China, Russia, and the United States in Afghanistan?
The oil issue, major issue, and has been one for a century. The British Empire was pushing up into that region. There was a series that was on PBS many years ago called Riley Ace's Spy. I don't know if you remember it or not. But it was a wonderful – they have it at our library, I know, because we took it out to watch it for the week. But it's a wonderful story, and it talks about these kind of routines, the stuff that was going on in the late 19th century, early 20th century, over the oil in Baku and Azerbaijan, and the comings and goings of the various intelligence services at the time who were interested in securing the oil rights and in the weapons deals that were being done in that time period, before the Bolshevik Revolution, before 1916, 1970, World War One type stuff. Fascinating time period. That is all. Afghanistan sits in the middle of vast, of a transit spot for oil and gas pipelines that go from the Arabian Sea up in through the pipelines will go in that direction up into Azerbaijan, up into South Central Asia, from South Central Asia to Western Europe. There is a pipeline right now that is a pipeline deal that was just completed with Iran as an example that's going to wind up in Austria. You have the development, you have this enormous concentration of industrial power now developing in India, China. They're going to rival anything the world has ever seen in the next 25 to 50 years. In fact, as we know right now, China, you can't buy anything without the label Made in China on it.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of industries on it, and we're just at the beginning of that curve at this point. So all those pipelines... Not only that, but Afghanistan has been looked at by various geological surveys over the last 5 or 6 years, and it turns out that there are vast resources there as well. I've got a piece right in front of me right here from 2008. It says that there are plenty of factors suggesting that China is set to increase its investment in Afghanistan in the near future. Afghanistan has unexplored reserves of oil and natural gas in the northern parts of the country. The Afghan oil reserves were recently upgraded 18 times by a U.S. Geological Survey. estimates standing at a mean of 1,596 million barrels, while Afghanistan's natural gas reserves were upgraded by a factor of three, standing at a mean of 15,687 trillion cubic feet.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's just oil and gas.
And there's also the other issue of Saudi Arabia and the belief that the Saudi oil fields may actually at some point diminish. So a lot of the long-range planning that really has been targeting Afghanistan, you know, in terms of being, you know, an independent nation that really did not serve the needs, let's put it that way, of the geopolitical strategy that had viewed this region as important to control. In fact, you know, the concept of Eurasia and controlling Eurasia, the Halford Mackinder idea, the 19th century British mm-hmm. geostrategist, who basically is still being really utilized, you know, in terms of justifying certain kinds of agendas today, that controlling this region is considered critical to controlling the world, and that, but that again, when you bring in the Saudi situation and you look at the idea of colonizing effectively Afghanistan, and that's really what this whole crisis is about, how to deal with Afghanistan today. It really depends on what you choose as an outcome, you know. And when they talk about helping the Afghan people, you know, we have to be very careful about
right.
you know how serious a statement that is. And this is where, you know, we really have to watch, you know, the choices that are being made in terms of, you know, sort of this idea of, oh, let's just withdraw all the troops. Well, that may sound wonderful, and certainly we personally don't feel that a military solution was ever a realistic way to deal with the crisis in the region. But that doesn't mean that, you know, if you simply remove NATO and the United States at this point without dealing with Pakistan, without dealing with the fact that the insurgency from 1973 on has always come from Pakistan
yeah.
to break down Afghanistan. And it is still a crisis that's coming out of Pakistan. So we have to really deal with the, you know, the other side of the equation, as it were.
Yes. Well, and another point that was given to me was that I guess Karzai, the current president of Afghanistan, it was a former executive, I guess, with UNICAL, or had something to do with UNICAL, which was involved in building a pipeline through the area, an oil pipeline.
Well, go ahead. Karzai, you know, Hamid Karzai's influence is, Hamid Karzai fits a lot of, you know, wears a lot of hats in this.
Mm-hmm.
He was the man to go to back in the late 1990s and early, you know, 2000s. I think he actually denies that he was on the, you know, that he had anything to do with UNICAL, but there were so many people who did
yeah.
that it was interesting that, you know, that were supporting Karzai, that it's really, you know, it's not a critical factor. But there were so many interesting, there's some interesting things about, you know, as Liz was saying about,
yeah.
you know, that the Texans are in the oil business and the Saudis are in the oil business. You know, if you look at some of the individuals who've been involved in pushing, you know, what was going on in the 1980s and in the 1990s there, in terms of these pipelines as an example, Dan Rather is an example, Texan. Milt Bearden, the guy who ran the operation for the CIA, he was a Texan. Robert Oakley, the ambassador to Pakistan.
Charlie Wilson.
Jim Baker is an example, okay? Jim Baker is the Baker Botts, is
right.
a law firm in Texas, okay? They handle, you know, they mainly handle oil contracts. You know, that's their big thing. Back in the early 1980s, we wound up doing a story down in South Texas, and one of the places we had to go to get interviews was Baker Botts, because it was about the, you know, oil leases, about a, you know, someone down there. So, you know, this has been, people tend to think, and, you know, I know I do, and I know people in Kansas tend to think this way, you tend to think this way, we tend to think of our country going off and doing something in a, you know, in a foreign country, how we're represented. What we don't realize is that there are a lot of individual interests, a lot of corporate interests that over the years, you know, have basically taken control of the levers of power, and they know how to work those levers very well, now more so than ever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you look back to the Clinton era, back in the 1990s, Washington, really, the number of lobbyists just increased dramatically. And I know that under the Obama administration, that was one of the things that was, everyone was shocked to see, the number of lobbyists that have increased in Washington. just in the year since he's been there. So, you know, this is a
You mean more than the Bush years?
than the Bush years.
I don't think people are aware of that.
So that's why you discover that, you know, in terms of things that are done overseas, and we think of the American people are rallied to support a cause. Well, what you're in a lot of cases, what you're getting, you know, what you're rallying behind is somebody's corporate interest. And, you know, they're in a position with their public relations firms. And this, as I said again, this is one of the reasons why the United States has been so ineffective in dealing with Afghanistan.
In fact, you really have to qualify even what is ineffective. What's ineffective on one level, for instance, for the Afghan people, may be very effective for someone else. So we constantly have to realize that we're being served up at the media level an idea about what the United States government is going into Afghanistan to do, but the evidence is in what is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, you know, you come up against all these interests that really have always played a major role in determining Afghanistan's fate. And this is clearly why you have to go back to the original use of Afghanistan as the place to draw the Soviets in, and to hold them there and beat them there, which, of course, created a crisis that the Afghan people have now been living with since 1979. And as we go through, you know, each evolution of this crisis with, you know, the Afghan people have always been claimed to be, you know, when you go back and look at what was going on, President Reagan claimed he was helping the Afghan people. Charlie Wilson claimed he was helping the Afghan people. You know, we look at George Bush. He went in there to help the Afghan people, help especially women.
That's what he said. Yeah, he and Laura too, his wife too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when you and President Clinton, I mean, we have to go back to the 1990s. The origin of the Taliban. The Taliban is a wholly owned subsidiary of Pakistani intelligence. It was created and started in 1992 with the intention of creating a Pakistani-friendly government in Afghanistan. Now, I don't know about, you know, how that affects other people, but I know when I hear something like that, I say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like it might be good for Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we have to keep in mind when we hear things like that. The Taliban was never meant to be good for the Afghan nation. It was always meant to be good for Pakistan, okay? It was not only not good for the Afghan nation, it was called gender apartheid in the 1990s, what was going on there. And Clinton administration was absolutely trying to recognize it. We have people like Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State under President Clinton, touting how good the Taliban was going to be when they first emerged. There was a lot of push to really view what was going on with the takeover of the Taliban as somehow good for the next stage of Afghanistan. And of course, we all know now that the imprisonment of Afghan women was really what the result was. Now we're back there again. Now we're hearing it all again. Well, Taliban really, we should really be figuring out, we should talk them into the government. Let's bring them in. That's the ticket. So you see the repeat of this process over and over again. And again, we have to go back to the origin of the Taliban. That's all we have to think about. The Taliban is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Pakistani intelligence, and even the Afghan Taliban, they keep trying to separate and claim they're only doing what they do based on their belief. They believe in Sharia law and their desire to create an Islamic state. So this kind of covers the whole, you know, kind of gives an overlay to the whole underpinnings of the origin of what the Taliban is and the role that Pakistani intelligence plays in running the Taliban.
Which your book goes into, and listeners, that's why one of the reasons the most intriguing stuff was the, you know, when you put your finger on the Taliban, we're out here listening to the news. It suddenly went from counterterrorism to counterinsurgency, from soldiers on the ground on National Public Radio using these terms interchangeably, and even some of them, these are from soldiers on the ground saying that the Taliban is not necessarily the Taliban. People are trying to sort out just what are people up against in Afghanistan, and I think it's hard for us to wrap our heads around it when many of my listeners who come to my farm in our little small little debate society and on the emails that I receive, when Glenn Beck is advocating, he just did this 2 weeks ago, or excuse me, a week and a half ago, he said straight up, we either need to get out or bomb the hell out of them. That's exactly, that's a quote, unquote, we either get out now or bomb the hell out of them. And, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to wrap my head around this fact that I heard this years and years and years ago, and you know, the secret bombing of Cambodia. And mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure this how to explain this to people, because I'm suddenly hearing former Bush Republican stalwarts in Jefferson County, Kansas, come up and sound like anti-war people.
You know,
take it or leave it. I'm take it or leave it. I'm sorry. I'm just telling you, people are now suddenly getting cold feet, and they're not talking about withdrawing from Iraq or any of the other military bases. They're talking lock, stock, and barrel out of Afghanistan, and I find it fascinating why they're saying suddenly these people who were gung ho about the war, the so-called war on terror, are now, like I said, sounding like they're anti-war in Afghanistan.
Well, you know, Afghanistan does has a very, very powerful effect on the psyche.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look back to Alexander the Great in terms of Western civilization, it's been a test of the West's ability to conquer the East. And you know, Alexander the Great was very successful. Alexander the Great was very successful up until the time he got to Afghanistan, and he took a beating there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, and the same thing, of course, as we know, happened to their first invasion. Their second invasion wasn't much better, and then they finally gave up after 1919, and they said, okay, fine, you can have your independence. And they tried to do the establishment of Afghanistan as a buffer state between the British Empire and the Russian Empire. And, you know, you have a situation where, you know, there are other aspects of this. This is a very interesting part of the world. This is a part of the world that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, a lot of mystics were interested in. I mean, the Himalayas are very nearby. The Pamirs is an example. We cite this. We have a chapter in the book called Mystical Imperialism.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
a great chapter adding Mystical Imperialism, because it was British. I didn't know that the British were so fascinated with go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about, you know, we inherited all this stuff, and we don't know where we got it. I mean,
right.
We got Vietnam from the French. I mean, the French actually were there for hundreds of years. They had colonies. They had a relationship. You know, there was a level at which the Vietnamese, you know, had absorbed French culture. I mean, there was a whole, you know, cultural relationship there. And the same British in Afghanistan. The British went in there. If you look at the documentation and the readings at the time, you can see that the British were trying to Christianize the world. That was their mission.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And if you look at the British East India Company as an example, was established in 1600 by a charter from Queen Elizabeth I, the objective of which was to bring this kind of almost market Calvinism into the world via their navy, and in order to compete with the Holy Roman Empire and the Spanish, who were at the time bringing back boatloads of gold from South America in order to build their empire. So this was a quasi-religious corporatization. And just remember, the United States, Jamestown Plantation and Plymouth Plantation in Massachusetts, those were plantations. Those were corporations that were established. The Pilgrims didn't come here to establish a free, you know, a democratic society in the United States. That occurred over a period of a century with the
mm-hmm.
development of a lot of Masonic, influences in the United States, of course, that occurred. And you have the same kind of thing happening in Afghanistan. The British got in there in the 19th century with the objective of Christianizing these regions. And in Africa, as an example, Cecil Rhodes was one of the big, promoters of this. And it was termed a kind of mystical imperialism. And that continued into the early 20th century. In fact, there were efforts at one point to try to align Germany under Hitler with Afghanistan in order to overthrow India. And I've read one of the things that I came across was that what Hitler was against the idea of overthrowing the British in India, because he thought that was a positive thing for Europeans to be penetrating into this part of the world and to be, you know, bringing European civilization to that part of the world. So once again, there's a mystical aspect to this that creeps in. Now, you can find it as well, and I cited it in some of the tables that you get from, you know, the Americans in, you know, the first Americans who went there diplomatically in the 1940s and the 1950s and the 1960s about establishing Christian, you know, Christian missions, as an example, in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually met someone who was trying to do that, who still is operating a kind of Christian operation in Afghanistan now.
And that's what was so interesting, I thought, about the Alexander Burns quote, where he makes the point of letting the British know that the Afghan people have nothing against the Christian world, have nothing against the British Empire.
Right.
But once the British Empire wanted to invade their country, wanted to take them over, they had a lot against them. So I think this is a very important point that we must realize, that not every people that the British Empire encountered in its attempt to colonize the world necessarily had open arms like that, you know, in terms of accepting them who they were. And this is a critical difference that we need to really appreciate about the Afghan lived experience. This was a crossroad of empires, but it's also been the crossroad of, and they call it the graveyard of empires, but it's also been a place where many, many belief systems have commingled and have existed. The Gandhara Buddhism was came out of this region, existed there. The Bamiyan statues that were destroyed by the Taliban. Apparently they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of monks who lived all around this area, Buddhist monks. So you have all kinds of belief systems. When we talk to our Afghan friends, they talk about their Jewish friends that they grew up with, their Hindu friends, Zoroastrian friends. That this was a very, very cosmopolitan encounter, and they accepted all kinds of belief systems, but they didn't want to be converted. That's all. That was as simple as it was.
You know, it's really very interesting in terms of this cultural thing. Liz mentioned the Buddhist origin. We were in Afghanistan with Sima Wali in 2002, a short time after the war ended, and we were at the Minister of Culture's office, and we did an interview with him, and then when the interview was over, he said, "I want to show you something." He went over to a cabinet and took this Buddha from his cabinet.
Uh-huh.
He said, "Notice the features on the Buddha." He said, "They're Caucasian features. They're not Oriental features." So he said, "I have," he says, "the Japanese," he said, "come here all the time." He says, they're fascinated. They fund, the Japanese actually fund a lot of the archaeological expeditions in Afghanistan to these ancient sites. He says, because there's apparently something in the origin of Afghan Buddhism that migrated to Japan and formed the basis of their Shinto religion.
He looked at the face of the
Buddha, and he said, "This is not an Oriental god. You know, this is not an Oriental Buddha. This is a Western Buddha." You know, this big smile on his face, and he says, "You know, we tend to think in the West," and he considered himself to be a Westerner.
Right.
He said, "We tend to think of ourselves in the West as being influenced by these Oriental ideas, and that Buddhism is Oriental idea. And here it is. It's really as much a part of our West as it is a part of the East."
Yeah.
When you hear ideas like, you know, whether it was Glenn Beck saying we should either desert the people effectively of Afghanistan or just bomb the place, I think that, you know, this is not the first time that I think that we have already seen this happen. I think that this is the point that what happens is we keep being drawn back, and I think this is really the challenge for the United States. We actually have been involved with Afghanistan actively since the 1970s, but what's happening now is it's the American people who are becoming aware of that activity, and now suddenly what is going on in Afghanistan, you know, is becoming common knowledge to Americans. This is where getting Americans to the point where we have an appreciation of what it is we're talking about. So when you would hear something like what Glenn Beck said, "Bomb the place." You know, I mean, this is really, it's not even worthy of a discussion.
Yeah.
It is so primitive.
Right.
But yet we know that people are influenced by that because they've been led to believe, this is again what our book is trying to undo, is the idea that Afghanistan is such a primitive place, it's so much the cause of its own problem,
mm-hmm.
that it, by bombing it away, it's like getting rid of the problem.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It's horrible, and the people in where I live are bombed literally by radio programs like Glenn Beck on literally on every AM radio station,
mm-hmm.
and there a lot of the young Republican workers that I know come out and they listen to them on the to and from work or to work in the morning, and on the tractors you can hear it blaring on the radio while they're out working the corn and soybean fields. And when gas got up to $4 a gallon, last summer, whenever it was, summer before last, people really started thinking, like you say, Elizabeth, they started really thinking about just what are we getting involved in? What kind of effect is this going to have? Our dalliances, our militarized multi-hundred-billion-dollar adventures around the world. People really started thinking about that. And now that Glenn Beck is blasting them with these ideas that we need to either get in, and I think that he's referring to like not just 40,000 troops or anything like that. He's talking about really a troop escalation on the scale of what maybe Lyndon Baines Johnson thought of, or bomb them. And actually, I heard him with my own ears, and I don't listen to him regularly. I only except to study him to criticize for my people who come out and visit with me, he actually was his co-host was advocating using thermonuclear weapons on the place,
mm-hmm.
and
I'm
just blown away by that, and I'm like going, do you really, and these people come to me well meaning, they know that's not the answer, but they're so fed up with the intrigue and the background deals that are going on. They're people. I've got a 12-year-old son, and I got a nephew who's, by the way, is of the same genetic mix or whatever you want to call it, racial mix. He's his mother's Caucasian, his father is African American, and he's done three tours. He's still in Iraq. Three tours in Iraq. This is personal. And my son's 12 years old, and I'm scared to death that we're going to be looking at a situation in 6 years where he'll be thinking he may be into this situation in this mad mix of the military-industrial complex, a word, a phrase coined by a Kansan, President Dwight David Eisenhower.
Well, he certainly put his finger on the problem when he did it. As I said to you before, there is a mentality here that we've all grown up with.
Yeah.
And what we did when we stepped into the Afghan story was we stepped outside of that mentality. And we've been looking at it from outside that ever since and trying to inform Americans that it's not what you think it is. There are foreign policy issues all over the world and analogies to Vietnam, but the fact is that Afghanistan is its own very special case.
Yes.
And the fact is that, you drop a bomb on that part of the world, and that will be, let me put it this way, that will be the death knell of the United States. If the United States had its opportunity for introspection and the opportunity to finally look at itself at the end of the Vietnam War. Instead of looking at itself in the way it did things,
mm-hmm.
it got involved in giving the Russians their Vietnam at this kind of revenge situation.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're dealing with, we walked through the mirror, so to speak, when we did that in Afghanistan. And now we are where the Russians were in 1979, 1980, 1985. There's a lot of people who are, this happened in the Soviet Union during the same time period. And the same thing is happening to the United States. And it's almost, they were like America's evil twin. That was the way it was presented to us in the United States, was the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
We came up both at the same time. We both became world powers at the end of World War II. The competition between the two major superpowers. And now, conversely, we're living through the same kind of economic degeneration, the same kind of political degeneration, the same kind of military degeneration. I mean, our guys have been there for 8 years
mm-hmm.
now, and the situation's getting worse and worse. The only thing that we did, as Dwight Eisenhower said, we put all our eggs in one basket, in 1947 with the beginning of the Cold War. And now that basket, and that, what Vietnam demonstrated was that those eggs don't work. Those eggs don't win you the war. We've been in Afghanistan now for 8 years with this basket, using the same kind of. There's an article. One of the things that McChrystal is even critical of. There's an issue of Newsweek out right now. There's an interview with McChrystal in there, and he's trying the military to change its culture. He said, you know, talk about dropping thermonuclear weapons. I mean, he's saying 2,000-pound bombs shouldn't be used. He said, what the heck are we using 2,000-pound bombs to drop on a mud hut in the middle of Afghanistan? He said, this is beyond pointless. So you see, Glenn Beck is pointlessness without a point. I don't know any more, you know, this is taking nihilism to an extreme that I don't think nihilism or Nietzsche ever even thought of, you know?
Right.
Glenn Beck is a negation of a negative issue.
He is a statement of, I think, just frustration that's very ignorant.
Yeah.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
But that's part of the problem. The American people don't realize that we have been sheltered from so much important information. So when you finally notice something, you have to realize that there's been 30 and 40 and 50 years of all kinds of activities done on your behalf, America, that were done in your name. And now you're seeing the effect of some of these things and saying, oh, well, let's just get out. Well, it isn't that simple.
No, it's not.
It isn't that simple. We have got, I think, in the case of Afghanistan, and this is what our book lays out, we don't just have a moral obligation here. We're talking about a legal obligation, that in fact it is arguable that Afghanistan may never have been put into this crisis had it not been for the intentional drawing of the Soviets into Afghanistan, holding them there, financing the Mujahideen and all of the various Islamists that then became empowered, and a lot of the instability in the region can be directly tied to that project, to that process.
I mean, if you look, and this is what we've seen from the very beginning, Afghanistan today is very much the creation of the United States, London, and Peshawar, as an example, and of Pakistan. If the United States needs to resort to doing this in order to win what they then the United States is basically, as I said, dropping a bomb on itself, committing suicide, because this is a creation of the United States. This is not Afghanistan. The Taliban, even the Mujahideen, the seven Mujahideen groups the United States supported during the 1980s, were as alien to what the Afghan people were all about, what their political system was all about up until 1978 and 1980, as any foreign colonial power. So, I mean, this is a delineation. This is the difference between, I mean, you cannot look at the situation in black and white. There are shades of gray here. There are complexities. And the United States has to start developing the means by which we understand and delineate between these various gradations of, of who is what, who is doing what to whom. And, you know, a lot of these things are basically, if the United States could implement some of these things politically, they could support a positive growth politically in Afghanistan. That would represent more than just a change for Afghanistan. It would represent a change for the way in which the United States conducts itself overseas. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the things that have been talked about, this counterinsurgency effort, this AFPAC, is the United States doesn't have the infrastructure to implement it. They need thousands of diplomats. They need thousands of Pashto speakers, as an example. Thousands of people who can speak Urdu. They need thousands of people with expertise who are willing in government service to go into Afghanistan and live in the villages with the Afghan people and work with them to help them create these democratic structures and organizations. And those people, the United States government is simply not geared to doing that.
And I think that the most important point I think that the United States certainly has to realize is that you cannot go into a shattered society, an atomized society, as Afghanistan is today, and basically start by thinking the solution is not only to bring it in as a military solution, but the first that raising the Afghan military and the Afghan police is the first move. This is part of the problem.
Mm.
You have a population of people who need to bring a genuine stability. They have got a 40 to 50% unemployment rate. That has more to do with the success of the Taliban than anything. anything at all. And this is a direct result of the idea that everything had to come from this position of either military or police as the protector in some way.
Yeah.
Part of the way the people will be protected is by their economy coming back, by their infrastructure being rebuilt. Now, yes, they do need some level of protection in order to get it going, but you can't then view, you know, the idea that raising an Afghan, you know, an Afghan military is as important as getting the water up and running for the whole country, getting power up and running for the whole country. This is the kind of you know, illogic that's going on, because I really do think that when you think that way, you'll end up creating really an imbalanced, at best, you may end up with another military state next to Pakistan.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's really what the proposal is to build up the Afghan military to rival Pakistan's military. But Pakistan has a million-man army.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The story, the joke, and it's not really a joke about Pakistan, is that, you know, most countries have a military. Well, in Pakistan's case, the military has a country.
Yeah.
And that's what the United States is up against, and that's been completely confused from the very beginning in terms of what the objectives are. The United States has still been trying to work with Pakistan and been giving money, $15 billion have been given to Pakistan from 2001 until 2007. And Pakistan was using that money for its war, for a potential war against India, and not using it to fight terror in its tribal areas. And the terror in its tribal areas is a result of the way in which it was left after the British left in 1947. That's a direct result of the British colonial era, whereby the Pashtun population was divided right down the middle by British policy in 1893 that was left intact in 1947. And those areas have been denied political representation. They have been denied any kind of economic development. They've been basically controlled by the Punjabi majority that controls the military. So this is an ethnic, a socio-ethnic issue that goes on inside Pakistan. It's very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has got itself, once again, because of its lack of sophistication politically, has got itself involved in an ancient tribal warfare that's been going on for 500 years between the various tribes inside Pakistan and Afghanistan.
In the back of your book, you have several. I understand, first off, that a copy of this fantastic book was sent to President Obama. I can only pray that he reads it. And in the back of the book, you have some of these proposals you outline really clearly. I think there's like 20 of them or 25. And it's an amazing book. This is one of the most important books I've ever read when it comes to understanding how foreign policy is established and the ramifications it has on an ancient culture like the people in Afghanistan. I'm really honored to have you on, and I appreciate every minute I've had on the phone with you. Thank you so much, Paul and Elizabeth.
Well, thank you so much
for
having us. It's really great to be able to expand on some of these ideas, you know, to have the time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we wish your audience the best as well, because these are complicated issues, but we as Americans really need to get up to speed. You know, it's a complex
mm-hmm.
world we're living in, and, you know, I think we've dropped enough bombs on everybody, and we don't want any dropped on us. So, you know, we have the resources to make a difference in this world, and I know that we can make that kind of difference.
Yes, thank you. Elizabeth, thank you so much for helping me round up Shanghai Paul into this. I appreciate every bit of this. Can you tell us what are you working on now, or you got a project? I know you're. What are you doing, folks?
Well, we're doing the next book. We're going to be, you know, getting further into the, you know, the issue of the Afghanistan, the region, Pakistan, what's really going on, what's been going on really in the last, you know, 9 months,
uh-huh.
And that we couldn't put in the book that is there. And also, it'll be a lot more concise in terms of really focused on the here and now, whereas, you know, Invisible History really gives you the whole history.
Yeah, right.
So you kind of get up to speed. This is really going to be here and now.
Well,
that should be coming out next September.
Next September, really? Will it be through City Lights?
Yep.
Yes, it will be.
It will.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, folks, there's a scoop for you. That courtesy of Radio Free Kansas. Hold on just a minute. Thank you. Yes, Django Reinhardt and his buddy on the violin, Stefan. What an interview, huh? Or, as I prefer to call it, an extended conversation. There's others on the way. And I, by the way, I want you to know at the back of their book, of Paul and Elizabeth's book, there's an epilogue, the 21st chapter. And they also, the chapter preceding, has a 14. At the time, I hadn't really counted the thing. They've got a 12 concise proposals to the under the chapter, What Can President Barack Obama Do? And here, I want to read one paragraph, and then we've got to go. The United States is in a fight for its life, not because of what happened on that September 11, 2001, but because of the way America responded to it. That response was at once wildly exaggerated, dangerously reckless, and in the end, ineffective, putting more control into the hands of the very same people who had allowed it to happen. Imperial presidency aside, the roots of this dilemma stem from the reality creation machine dreamed up by Dean Acheson, George Kennan, Paul Nitze, and James Forrestal at the beginning of the Cold War. But the continuing problem lies in the psychology of the people who were given the authority to drop the first atomic bomb and fantasize a horrific new reality of their own, that, quote, small and exceptionally inbred collection of men, a new elite that would eventually emerge as a power elite, and whose power would come not from the wealth or family or brass stripe, but from their having conceived and elaborated a set of ideas, unquote. Today, those men, their ideas and their legacy are destroying the United States, not willfully, but by their sheer inability to live within the framework of the observable world, demystify their process, and end the nightmare. It's not complicated. The future father of the hydrogen bomb, Edward Teller, gambled with his fellow physicists in the New Mexico desert on whether the first atomic explosion would ignite the Earth's atmosphere and end life on the planet. Physicist John von Neumann suggested covering the polar ice caps with dye to reduce their reflectivity and, quote, jiggle the entire planet, unquote, into a semi-tropical paradise. Free market proponent, futurist, and RAND analyst Herman Kahn, K-A-H-N, Dr. Strangelove, referred to the Strategic Air Command's battle plan for nuclear conflict as a, quote, war orgasm, unquote, and worked up a scale of 44, quote, rungs of escalation to make nuclear war not only possible, but desirable. Hailed by science and glorified by the American media, these are the class of men whom our leaders have looked to for guidance for three quarters of a century. In the process, they have made our politics meaningless, transformed our democracy into a ritualistic procedural farce, and turned us all into clockwork oranges to sign on to our own destruction. Well, and that's from their 12th and final proposal to President Barack Obama, trying to get you, too, to listen and think about where the future is going to be for our empire. Well, I want to send out a howdy doody to Dave Davis, contributing editor Dave Davis to the Fightin' Cock Flyer blog. The news ticker's been running slow, Dave. He's in Bolivia, listeners. Yes, he's in Bolivia. And he said he'd try to listen in. Also to my friends, my friend Frank Prophet, who plays a lot of music for me. in my show. You've heard Frank Proffitt out of Lawrence, Kansas. He and his beloved are traveling right now as we speak into Istanbul, Turkey. We're going to finish the show out with Frank Proffitt's Rollin' and Tumblin', his version. Good night from Radio Free Kansas. Email me at bluebarn3central. Good night from Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Email me anytime, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Good night from North Jefferson County, Kansas.